into a thick bonbon of pig fat and pops them into his mouth with his fingers, who wouldn't know which fork to use for the fish appetizer if the butler snatched it off the table in frustration and stabbed him in the face with it. So unfair that this kind of man could have had a woman like Inga Schenek. Jurgen says, I admired her grace, her style, her taste. Dubose nods.
Exactly why she was drawn to me.
You never told me about this.
I don't talk about my ladies. A gentleman is always discreet.
Discreet? You just said she was insatiable. Dubose looked puzzled.
She's dead. So what's to be discreet about after she's packed off in a coffin?
For a moment, Jurgen stares in silence at the windmills looming behind the house, their enormous blades carving the air and probably a significant number of birds in any 24-hour period. The sun flares off the solar panels. The stucco is a bilious shade of green. A ragged dog of numerous heritages wanders into the driveway in front of them, squats, and takes a dump. I'm in hell, Jurgen says. I don't believe in hell, but what is this? He sweeps one hand across the vista before them, where the dog craps in front of a house that by all appearances is built from the animal's previous defecations. What is this if it isn't hell? Dubose cocks his head and raises one eyebrow.
Are you going all dramatic on me? We can't afford existential angst in our line of work. My advice is don't watch those historical dramas on PBS. They just get your panties in a wad. Don't watch, and you'll be happier. I want you to be happy, my friend.
Comme vous êtes gentil.
Jurgen butters the flattery and thank yous with sarcasm.
Vous êtes trop aimable. Merci infiniment.
Dubose sighs and shakes his head.
De rien, mademoiselle.
Astonished by this revelation, Jurgen says, You speak French?
Do bears shit in the woods?
He places a hand on Jurgen's shoulder.
Buddy, calm yourself. If just the outside of this place freaks you, then you won't be able to handle what's inside.
Enduring the hand on his shoulder because it will be there only a moment, Carter Jurgen says, Yeah? What's inside?
Dead people.
I've seen plenty of dead people. Made a few of them myself.
Yeah. But these didn't die pretty.
Chapter 6. As though he read disapproval in Jane's face, Ferrante Escobar said, We sell only to wealthy, reputable clients, needing protection in an increasingly dangerous world. They don't want to risk having their weapons known and confiscated if some crisis leads to martial law. Many of them have large security staffs, and they buy in bulk, but we don't sell to anyone who might intend to resell. His self-justifications were self-delusions, but Jane couldn't afford to alienate Ferrante Escobar. She must be in Borrego Valley this afternoon. She'd already needed more time to put together this operation than she would have liked. Further delay was unthinkable. Nevertheless, instead of responding to his declaration that he would not accept money from her, that he wanted something else in return for the pistol, she said again, How much? Anxiety molded his face. This is a world of lies, and always has been. We live in a time of even greater deceptions than in centuries past. So much of what we're told, what we see on TV, what we read in the newspapers, or on the internet, is invented to conceal the truth. Protect the wicked. Increase the power of those who already have more power than all the kings of history combined. I don't disagree, she said. But what does that have to do with the price of a pistol? He became more excited, speaking fast. Earlier, he'd been unable to endure her stare for more than a moment. Now, he was unable to look away. They claim you're a true monster, no redeeming qualities, so dangerous, vicious, hateful. But all they've done is make you as unreal as this supervillain in some bad Batman movie. All over the internet, they're talking about what you really might be. They think you know something that could bring down a lot of powerful people. Ferrante continued to meet her eyes, but his demeanor changed. He pressed his right hand over his heart, his left over the right, as if his heart must be pounding so hard and fast that pressure needed to be applied to quiet it. With this strange posture came a change in his voice. He spoke neither as fast nor as loud as before, and there was a new tone that she could not at first name.
"They say, maybe, you have proof of something big, but you can't find a way to use it or get it out to the public. Because everything is so corrupt these days, because you have to run as fast as you can just to stay alive."
When he fell silent, Jane said, "And what do you think?" Anxiety faded from his face, and a tenderness replaced it.
"I think you're the truth in a sea of lies. There's a painting in the Louvre in Paris. I own a print of it. She's shown in armor when Charles VII was crowned the King of France."
"No," Jane said.
"You look nothing like her, but you're armored too."
Disturbed by what she now realized was Ferrante's reverence, she said, "I am nothing like her. God talked to Joan of Arc, or she thought he did. He's never talked to me. I got into this for selfish reasons, to restore my husband's good name, to save my son's life. If it's grown into something larger than that, it's not anything I ever wanted. I'm not made to carry that kind of weight. I can't save an entire freaking nation. I could be dead tomorrow. Chances are I will be dead. I'm tired and lonely and scared, and I'm under no illusion that God or some guardian angel will spare me from a bullet in the head if the bastard who pulls the trigger knows how to aim."
Ferrante's hands pressed over his heart looked melodramatic and foolish, but the esteem in which he held her was genuine, not at all diminished by her refusal to be what he imagined her to be. He said,
"If I had been there in the 15th century, at the coronation of Charles VII, I would have asked her for what I'm asking of you, the only thing I want from you. Ferrante, listen. I can't play something I'm not. I'm no saint in the making. The things I've done. Damn it, listen, I'm no good at make-believe. I've got both feet in the mud of reality. I slog from here to there. I don't fly. I screw up. Both feet in mud and blood."
He would not be deterred.
"All I want is your blessing. Touch my head and bless my life."
If she did as he asked, just as a kindness, with no illusion that her blessing had any power, Ferrante would nonetheless receive it as a sanctification of his heart, as a hallowing of his life. Knowing what false value he would place on it, if she still did as he wanted, she would, to some degree, be a fraud. She should do it anyway, do it for Travis, to avoid risking this man's displeasure. After all, she would kill for Travis, lie for him, commit any sin to save him. So she should be able, just for a moment, to pretend to be a conduit for divine grace. Yet she couldn't move toward him or bring herself to speak a benediction. She didn't understand her reluctance, nor was she able to put a name to the particular fault in herself that brought her to this impasse. She looked beyond Ferrante to the four grotesque paintings, and she thought about what Enrique had said.
"He's a weird duck. He's got this blood obsession. You meet him, you'll see."
Yes. But it turned out not to be the blood of violence and vengeance and hatred that enthralled Ferrante Escobar, but instead the blood of sacrifice, the concept of redemption through suffering. To some extent, that was an obsession that Jane, with both feet in the mud of life, could understand. Her gaze traveled from the paintings to the acrylic plinth on the desk, on which rested the bristling sculpture that had seemed strange and abstract when she'd first noticed it. She realized it was intricately braided brambles fashioned into a crown of thorns. If for whatever reason she could not bring herself to give him what he wanted, she could give him an alternative that might not leave him alienated. She stepped to the desk and, not with her gun hand, but with her left,
firmly gripped the sculpture and lifted it from the display pedestal, clutched it. She clenched her teeth to bite off any expression of pain and met his eyes for a moment before returning the sculpture to the acrylic. The thorns had dimpled her flesh in a dozen places, but blood bloomed only in tiny blossoms from 3 points on 2 fingers and from 4 punctures in her palm. Ferrante Escobar stared at her hand for a long moment, his face solemn, his dark eyes unreadable. Without another word, he picked up the box containing the pistol, went to the door, led her down the hallway to the client lounge, and left her there with the new gun. An adjacent restroom served the lounge. She cranked on the water and pumped soap from the dispenser and washed her hands. After she dried off, she clenched her left fist around a wad of paper towels, applying pressure to stop the thorn pricks from bleeding. She wondered if Ferrante would blot the drops of blood from the floors of his office in the hallway, and what he might do with the rag that absorbed them. She decided that she would rather not know. In the client lounge once more, she sat on a sofa. She looked at the box containing the pistol. She raised her head and stared at the frosted windows, which were set as high as those in Ferrante's office, and she thought about how strange her life had become, and about how many moments of it were resonant with cryptic meaning that would remain forever beyond her powers of interpretation. Chapter 7. A warm breeze, blade shadows scalping the barren earth, the ceaseless slish, slish, slish of carved air, perhaps one of the 2 windmills pumping water from a well in addition to cleaving energy from the breath of nature. As Jurgen and Dubose step out of their truck and approach the Corrigan house, the front door opens, and an Arcadian named Damon Ainsley descends 2 steps to a concrete pad that serves as a stoop. He is a robust man with a rosy complexion that has, in this case, paled from ear to ear and gone a little gray around the eyes.
"We've got a situation," Ainsley says. A thin and bitter laugh escapes him. "Situation? Hell's bells. I've become a jackass, more bureaucrat than lawman, politically correct and full of newspeak. The situation, gentlemen, is a shitstorm."
According to Dubose, Dr. Berthold Schenick, cuckolded husband of the fabulous Inga, had foreseen 2 types of sudden psychological collapse that might rarely ensue following the activation of a brain implant, the least dramatic being the disintegration of the ego and the id upon the recognition of being possessed and enslaved. In this case, the subject's sense of self dissolves. He loses all identity, all memory. He ceases to understand the environment around him and has no capacity for ordered thought. His mind becomes a shrieking bedlam. This is the more benign of the 2 possibilities. In the worst scenario, the ego disintegrates, but not the id, leaving the latter in charge. What remains in this case is a sense of self, a kind of situational and pattern recognition memory rather than recollection of personal experience, and a capacity for ordered but primitive thought. However, the id is the aspect of the mind that seeks pleasure at any cost. Without the moderating influence of the ego, which mediates between the primal desires of the id and the social environment in which we live, there is no Dr. Jekyll anymore, nor even Mr. Hyde, but only a pleasure-seeking thing. Damon Ainsley heads toward one of the Jeep Cherokees.
"Gotta smoke some weed to float away the nausea. Better prepare yourselves before you go in there." "I was born prepared," Dubose says.
As Carter Jurgen learned during his years at Harvard, there are 2 explanations for what is called the reptile consciousness within the human id, supposing that it exists. A scientist might say human beings are not evolved from apes so much as from all the species that constitute the history of life on Earth's land masses, which means that the first lizard to venture from sea to shore has left its genetic trace in us. On the other hand, a priest might say our reptilian impulses are the curse bestowed by the father of serpents in the Garden of Eden. In either case, the reptile consciousness has no capacity for love, compassion, mercy, or any other virtues prized by civil societies. It is driven solely by its hunger for pleasure, and one of those pleasures is the thrill of violence. As DuBose opens the door of the Corrigan house, he pauses and pretends to be profound, a pose he finds appealing now and then.
This is a moment to remember, my friend. Dr. Shenick thought there was a 1 in 10,000 chance of a psychological collapse. More than 16,000 have been adjusted with implants, and this is the first instance of what he predicted. For you and me, it's like being there when Edison tested the first successful light bulb.
Such grandiose declarations coming from the hillbilly sage, great on Jurgen. How the hell is it like Edison's light bulb?
It's an historic moment.
Damon Ainslie just called it a shitstorm. A shitstorm isn't my idea of an historic moment. The big man favors Jurgen with an expression like that of a patient adult speaking to an amusing but clueless child.
History isn't just an endless series of triumphs, Carter. History is about the ups and downs. It was an historic moment when the Titanic sank.
They step into the house. Chapter 8. The rat-coat gray, torn-rag sky over the Gulf of Mexico, creeping across blackening waters, the morning sun steadily retreating from the shore, the coastal plain just 20 feet above sea level, the maze of oil refineries looking flat in the shadowless light of an oncoming storm, like a pencil drawing hung on a wall. To Egon Gottfried, on the trail of Ansel and Claire Hawk, the city of Beaumont, Texas, appears to be more detailed than Worsted, where all this began. But the unknown playwright is still sketching the locale rather than painting it in fullest depth and color. Behind the wheel of his Rhino GX, Gottfried follows Tucker Tredmont's GMC Terrain through the outskirts of the city into open country, Rupert and Vince close behind in their Jeep Wrangler. This solemn train of black vehicles feels like a funeral procession, sans corpse, though it's easy enough to make a corpse if one is needed. Along a two-lane blacktop, they come into fields of coarse matted grass and tortured weeds from some of which depend clusters of pale bladders the size of thumbs. At certain times of the year, perhaps portions of this land become marshes from which, at dusk, clouds of mosquitoes rise in such great numbers that they blacken the sky even before the last light has gone from it. The GMC Terrain slows, signals a right turn, leaves the pavement for the wide shoulder of the road, and comes to a stop. Gottfried parks behind it, Rupert Baldwin behind Gottfried. Tredmont waits in front of his vehicle, frowning at the grim sky, drawing deep breaths and snorting them out, as though he is part hound and can assess the potential of the storm by the scent that it imparts to the air. For whatever reason, the nipples of his man-breasts have stiffened against his pale blue polo shirt, a sight about as erotic as a squashed cockroach.
"Why have we stopped?" Gottfried asks. "This is where I left them, the cowboy dude and his woman. This is where they wanted to go."
Gottfried and his men survey their surroundings with puzzlement. Vince Penn says,
"This is like the middle of nowhere. There's nothing. There's no place they could go. It's just fields. Just empty fields is all it is."
Pointing ahead and to the right, toward a narrow dirt lane that branches off the blacktop, Tredmont says,
"The last I saw them, they were walking that way."
In the distance, what might be a house and two outbuildings, or a mirage, imprint their small dark shapes on the landscape.
"Did they say who lives there?" Gottfried asks.
"I didn't ask. They didn't say, and I don't care."
Why didn't they want you to drive them over there? Didn't that seem odd to you?
Mister, maybe half of everything that happens in life seems odd as hell to me. Most of it stranger than this. Now I've got a living to make.
When Tredmont drives away, Rupert Baldwin squints at the distant buildings.
If we drive in, they'll for sure hear us coming. What do you say we walk it?
Like Rupert and Vince, Godfrey is carrying a pistol on his right hip. He also has a snub-nosed revolver in an ankle holster. The three of them set out on foot. Chapter 9. The living room at the Corrigan house is furnished for comfort, with a deep sofa of no particular style and three massive recliners, everything aimed at a big-screen television. Otherwise, the theme of the decor is nautical. The reproduced paintings of sailing ships in calm and stormy seas are the quality that big hotel chains purchase by the thousands. One lamp base is sheathed in artfully arranged seashells. Another features a porcelain mermaid topped by a painted shade on which porpoises cavort. Someone in this desert home yearns for the romance of the sea. A young DHS agent, whose name Carter Jurgen doesn't know, one of the Arcadian backup brigade that streamed into the valley during the past 36 hours, sits on the edge of one of the recliners. He smokes a cigarette, tapping the ashes into a conch shell, his hands shaking as if he's a palsied retiree. Radley DeBose says,
Harry, is it?
Yeah, the agent says. Harry Oliver.
On the phone, you called it a slaughterhouse. To me, it looks like Mayberry, USA.
A tremor ages Harry's voice to match his trembling hands.
The kitchen. The back porch. That's where.
Filtered through the roof and walls of the house, the sound of the windmills is not as it is outside, not like giant swords slicing the air, but rather a low, rhythmic hum. To Jurgen, it sounds as if some hive fills the attic, a teeming population busy wax-laying and honey-making and brewing a potent venom to ensure a lethal sting. He follows DeBose into a shadowy hallway where one of two bulbs is burned out in the ceiling light. Beyond open doors to each side, rooms are little revealed by sunshine leaking around the edges of closed draperies. On the walls between the doors, rough seas roll without motion, and tumultuous skies storm without sound. The first victim is just past the kitchen threshold. Homeland Security ID clipped to the breast pocket of his suit coat. On his back, face torn and puckered and hollowed by several bite marks, as eyeless as Samson in Gaza. The father, Rooney Corrigan, lies to the right of a chrome-legged dining table with a yellow formica top. He's also face up, though head and body are not joined. DeBose steps cautiously to avoid the biological debris that slathers the floor, and Jurgen follows with equal care. Rooney's younger of two teenage sons is sprawled beyond the table. The condition of the corpse is so appalling that Jurgen must look away.
It's the remaining son, DeBose says, who's suffered the psychological collapse. His name's Ramsay, from the Old English, meaning male sheep. Ironic, huh? He might have been a lamb once, but not anymore.
The mother had tried to flee. She'd made it out the back door and onto the screened porch. Blouse ripped away, bra torn off, face wrenched in terror, lips cruelly bitten, mouth agape in a silent scream. The wide-open eyes suggest that the last thing she'd seen was an abomination worse than her oncoming death. Her neck is broken. Here, on the screened porch, the sound of the windmills has yet a different character. The fine mesh that bars flying insects also seines the crisp edges from the slashing sword noise, so that the porch seems to be a way station between life and afterlife, where a host of spirit voices softly whisper secrets about what lies beyond death. DeBose says,
Let's go have a look at Ramsay.
Chapter 10. The dirt lane is elevated a foot or two above the flanking fields. It is hardpan in which Egon Gottfried and his men leave no tracks, nor are there any boot prints impressed by Ansel and Claire Hawk the previous day. Seen closer than from the paved road, the flourishing weeds are even stranger than they had seemed before, riotous thickets in great variety, many of the species unknown to Gottfried. His attention is drawn to certain gnarled bushes with needled leaves and wiry stems, from which are suspended clusters of pale sacks. From the highway, he'd thought the sacks were thumb-size, bladder-like, but they are larger and more like cocoons than bladders, but not cocoons either, vaguely reminiscent of something that eludes him. Perhaps because the eerie fields appear to be hostile, like some alien landscape that harbors unknown lethal life forms, Gottfried thinks of Judge Sheila Draper Cruxton and the angry dressing down she meted out to him in their most recent phone conversation. You better stop wasting your testosterone, Gottfried. Keep your pants zipped, man up, start breaking heads and get the job done. The dark clouds race north, harried by some high-altitude wind not felt at ground level. The sky lowers, and birds shriek overhead as they flee toward what few roosts of refuge this flat territory contains. As Gottfried and his men continue along the hardpan, they come to a place where the creepy bushes grow within a foot of the lane. He stops to peer more closely at them. The clustered and slightly wrinkled sacks are moist and milky, but not opaque. In fact, they are semi-translucent, and dark shapes are coddled within them, as if things wait therein to be born. But these are definitely not cocoons.
What is it? What are you doing? Rupert Baldwin asks.
Rupert and Vince have halted 20 feet ahead of him and are watching him inspect the plant.
I just thought... Gottfried shakes his head. Nothing. It's nothing.
As they continue toward the buildings, he stares at the bushes, fascinated beyond all reason. He wonders if the sacks are actually part of the plant. Although they aren't spun silk cocoons, perhaps they're extruded in another fashion by an insect unknown to him, the fields infested by some pestilence. Abruptly, he stops again when he realizes of what the sacks remind him. Pale, yes. Semi-translucent, yes. But they nonetheless resemble testicles.
Egon?
Rupert says. Yes, all right, he responds, and again he proceeds with them toward the buildings. He has no doubt now that the unknown playwright is endorsing Judge Draper Cruxton's instructions to break heads and get the job done. Recently, the author of all this has set the scenes with too little detail. These fields, however, are so vividly and intricately presented that they are meant to be a sign to guide him back to the proper performance of his role. Fields of testicle-bearing plants never seen before. They are put here to remind him of what Judge Draper Cruxton has demanded, and of what she has threatened should he fail to perform as expected. He has been under great stress, and this revelation has not relieved any of the pressure on him, but at least he now knows what he must do to avoid suffering the pain that the unknown playwright is so capable of doling out. Fulfill the dream he's had of Jane's in-laws. Shoot Ansel. Slit Claire's throat. Yes, they must first be captured, injected, and interrogated after being enslaved. But once they reveal the whereabouts of young Travis, they will be Gottfried's to dispose of as he wishes. He and his men have drawn close to the buildings and now better understand their nature. The house is old, weathered, offering more bare wood than paint. Sway-backed steps, some porch railing balusters broken, others missing. Most windows are shattered, and the few that remain intact stare blindly from behind cataracts of dust. The yard is weeds and crawling vines that climb the rotting walls of the abandoned residence. The darkest of the structures is a sun-scorched barn with a rusted metal roof and concave walls. What appears to be a small stable is in no better condition. Jane's in-laws are not likely to have hidden away in such ruins. Yet, the lane ends here, and no other dwellings are in sight. Maybe the scene is not only what it appears to be. Guns drawn, Godfrey, Rupert, and Vince begin the search. Chapter 11. The humble desert home now seeming almost to groan under the weight of an incidental, terrible grandeur bestowed by horror and tragedy, its rooms given a new dimension by a threat to the future of humanity that is here made manifest. Carter Jurgen is in the presence of the beast. The smell of blood and urine, the study window covered by draperies, only the desk lamp aglow. Ordinary shadows seem to pulse with threat. The master bedroom and Rooney Corrigan's home office are served by a different hallway from the one that connects the living room to the kitchen. In the office, DHS agents Solomon and Tara Tucci keep guard over 17-year-old Ramsey, who is in the desk chair. The teenager's wrists are zip-tied to the arms of the chair, his ankles to the center post from which radiate five legs with wheels. In light of what the kid has done, the zip ties have been deemed insufficient restraint. A length of rope twice encircles his chest and is knotted tightly behind the back of the chair. Likewise, rope crosses his thighs twice and secures him to the seat. Ramsey slumps in his bonds, eyes closed, chin on his chest. He appears to be sleeping, as if four savage murders have exhausted him. He's a sizable specimen, football linebacker material. His blonde hair is discolored by the spilled life of others, stiff and matted and spiked, spattered face, streaked clothes. Resting on the chair arms, his strong hands are gore-mottled, the creases of the knuckles dark with encrusted blood. Tara Tucci, who looks as though he changed careers from mafia muscle, sits in a chair about 5 feet from Ramsey. His pistol rests on his thigh and ready in his hand. Solomon wears a better suit than Tara Tucci's, a tailored white shirt and a club tie. His receding hair is white at the temples, his features patrician, his posture ramrod when he rises from a chair, his manner like that of a cultured attorney for a mainline law firm in business since the 1800s.
"Why is this haywire piece of meat still alive?" Radley DuBose asks. "Why didn't you make him as dead as the four in the kitchen?"
Solomon does his best to present the facts in a dispassionate, lawyerly recitation.
"For injection, we strapped the Corrigan family in the kitchen chairs. The newest iteration of the nanoweb was established in Mrs. Corrigan in 3 hours, 40 minutes. The final implant established in about 4 hours, 10 minutes. The last one was Ramsey Corrigan." Solomon glances at the young man in the office chair. "They all responded to the phrase, 'Do you see the Red Queen?' We ran the usual control tests. They were fully adjusted people."
Originally, the sentence that accessed the mind of an adjusted person and compelled him to follow commands was, "Play Manchurian with me," a reference to the classic novel of mind control, The Manchurian Candidate, by Richard Condon, published in 1959. After Jane Hawke learned the power of those four words and could make an adjusted person obey her, the sentence was changed to, "Uncle Ira is not Uncle Ira," a line from Jack Finney's 1955 novel, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Hawke, the troublesome bitch, learned that one too, necessitating the reprogramming of 16,000 adjusted people with yet another sentence, "Do you see the Red Queen?" This one, like the first, was from the Richard Condon novel, in which a brainwashed assassin, Raymond Shaw, was activated by the sight of the Queen of Diamonds whenever told to play a game of solitaire.
"We removed the restraints from all four," Solomon continued. "We instructed them how to search for Travis Hawke, what their role was. We're almost finished when..."
He looks at the teenager, this time with obvious dread.
"Ramsey puts his fists to his head and screams." "I never heard such a scream.
as if he was slammed by pain, rage, and terror all at once. He began to shake violently and scream louder. Something was wrong with the brain implant. Solomon isn't able to maintain his detachment. A slight tremor comes and goes in his voice. Sometimes he pauses before he can continue.
Kirk Granger, one of ours. The one dead in the kitchen. He rushes to restrain Ramsay before the kid hurts himself. Bends over him with fresh zip ties. Ramsay shrieks a long stream of obscenities worse than you'd hear in the most violent ward of a prison for the criminally insane. Not coherent, just vicious, rank. He comes out of his chair. He bites Kirk's face, bites it hard. So damn fast, snake quick. He tears into Kirk's face, his throat. He rips a carotid, maybe a jugular. Didn't see how he took the eyes. Kurt is a martial arts guy, but he's blinded, then dead, taken down in 5 seconds. Ramsay scrambles across the table, knocks his dad out of a chair, tramps his throat, snatches a cleaver from a rack, swings it. Such power! It's just 10 seconds after he first went nuts.
Dubose returns to his unanswered question. Why doesn't the son of a bitch have 5 bullets in his head? From his chair, without taking his eyes off Ramsay, Taratucci says, Don't be a jerk. You notice all the bullet holes in the kitchen cabinets, the walls? He's like some bat out of hell, how fast he moves. You can't hit what won't be a target.
Solomon says, Brother's dead. Mother runs for it. He wants her more than us, maybe to rape before he kills her, his own mother. It's chaos. But when we inject an entire household, we bring a Taser X REP 12 gauge in case there's effective resistance. So I put a round in his back while he's on the porch tearing at her clothes.
He was so gone, Taratucci says. He didn't know who she was.
Solomon says, She was already dead. When he caught her and dragged her down, she broke her neck.
Staring at Ramsay Corrigan, Dubose speculates,
He knew. He could feel something was deep inside his head, enslaving him. The control program tried to repress his fear, maybe applied too much pressure, burnt out some neurons, maybe the nanoweb itself badly malfunctioned, whatever, and just kicked his terror into hyperdrive, triggered a rapid-fire psychological meltdown. His psyche came apart like sugar lace. Personality dissolved. Shenek said this might rarely happen, but he hoped a collapse would end in a catatonic state or in a condition of feeble physical and mental incoherence. He didn't think an adjusted person damaged like this would instead plunge all the way down through the forbidden door.
Well, Jurgen says, damn if that's not another thing you never shared.
What door? Why forbidden? Shenek said nature is all about change, progressive change, always refining its creatures. Of course, it's impossible for one of us to revert through some genetic cataclysm to an earlier physical form in the evolutionary chain. You can't go to bed human and wake up an ape.
Shenek said the same is true about our psychological state. If the history of all life from the first lizard onward is like a series of ghosts in our genome, nature won't allow us to be haunted backward to a primitive consciousness because of any trauma. Nature will have built into our psyche a forbidden door, forever locked against the past of the species, and no event can open it.
Or, Shenek was wrong, Jurgen says. So then, hello, reptile consciousness.
I needed all 5 rounds in the Taser XREP, Solomon reveals, just to keep Ramsay disabled long enough for Taratucci and Damon Ainsley to restrain him again.
Dubose shakes his head.
You should have killed him. Let's roll the freak outside and do some target practice.
Can't, Solomon declares. The main lab in Menlo Park wants to study him. See if they can understand why the breakdown.
Bring the monster in for a chat, Jurgen says.
What could possibly go wrong? Solomon says, they're sending in a medevac helicopter and a team of CIA Black Ops tough guys to load him and get him there. Sedated. They don't want a sedative used in case it causes further disintegration. They want to study him just as he is. How many Black Ops guys? They said 4. I want 6. They think even 4 is too many. If Ramsey Corrigan has been asleep, now he wakes. He raises his head, which turns slowly left to right, right to left, like a turret on a tank as the gunner seeks a target. He focuses on Jurgen. Although there is nothing inhuman about the man's eyes, the ferocity of his attention makes his stare more intense than any Jurgen has previously encountered. Perhaps because of the horrific carnage in the kitchen, because Ramsey sits here in the blood of others and in his own urine, appearing eerily unconcerned and even confident in spite of being securely bound, his gaze imparts a chill to Jurgen. Although his shackles constrain him, he projects an impression of being tightly coiled and ready to strike. Kill him now, Jurgen warns. I agree, Solomon says. I wish I had. But now, the order transferring him to Menlo Park comes from the Central Committee, through the regional commander, from our cell leader. Anyone who pulls the trigger on Ramsey will be considered a traitor to the revolution. The consequences. Well, you know the consequences. Chapter 12. The abandoned house is a sanctuary for things that crawl and skitter and squirm, that produce a chrysalis in which to transform from something that creeps to something that flies, that find in wood both a home and a meal. Mold thrives, and rot has its way, and mushrooms sprout in the darker corners. There are the bones of dead rats, the feathers of birds that came in through broken windows and found their way out again, but no sign of Jane Hawk's in-laws. What was thought to have been a stable is in fact a chicken coop with ramps to elevated laying boxes for the hens, a crumbling structure where the muck soil floor is thatched with wet and moldy feathers that stick in clumps to Egon Gottfried's shoes. Nothing lives here now but a fat and hideous pale-faced possum that hisses at him and sends him scurrying out of the building, to the barely suppressed amusement of Rupert Baldwin and Vince Penn. The spavined barn, its rib studs cracked and termite-riddled, its wall slats warped and its doors sagging, has lost 2 panels of the metal roof, perhaps to a high wind. On a bright day, rectangles of sunshine would slowly lengthen and then shrink across its floor, and shadows would relent. But on this occasion, with a pending storm curdling the sky, the light is gray and diffuse, and in league with shadows to conceal the loft and every corner. The poor light doesn't matter. The loft ladder might once have had 20 rungs, but just 4 haven't rotted away. Ansel and Claire can't have climbed there to hide. Anyway, Godfrey has no need of more light to know that no one has taken refuge in the barn. From crumbling concrete footings to splintering walls to the metal roof rattling now in the stiffening wind, the structure is as devoid of human habitation as any crater on Mars. Wandering in search of clues, Vince Penn studies the floor that Godfrey has already studied.
Nope. No recent tire tracks. None at all. No oil or grease. Not a drop. Doesn't seem like anyone kept a vehicle here recently. Or even back in the day.
Worstead to Hawk Ranch, Hawk Ranch to Longren Stables, Longren to Killeen, Killeen to Houston, Houston to Beaumont, Beaumont to this ass end of nowhere.
Dust on the floor, says Vince Penn. Dust and like a million teeny tiny pieces of straw. We're leaving prints and disturbing all the chaff, but no tire tracks. Zero. Zip. Nada.
Judge Sheila Draper Cruxton has given Godfrey a disturbing ultimatum. and the unknown playwright is evidently displeased with how he has been intuiting the author's intent. While Rupert watches Vince much as he might watch, with pity and contempt, the hopeless progress of a crippled frog dragging itself laboriously toward its pond, the inimitable Agent Penn says,
"Looks like Ansel and Claire never came here. Not to the barn, or coop, or house. They walked to the end of the lane and kept walking. Went off through the field. Went somewhere else. Hard to say where."
None of this is real. Nothing but Gottfried's mind. The rest, illusion. Only radical philosophical nihilism makes sense of this otherwise chaotic world. None of it matters. Go with the flow.
"Yeah, it's a dead end," says Vince. "Blind alley, blank wall. Dead end."
He looks at Gottfried's feet.
"Hey, Egon, your shoes look funny. Rupert, don't his shoes look funny?"
Gottfried's shoes are caked in muck soil from the chicken coop. Stuck in that gluey mass are hundreds of feathers. The feathers were initially wet, but they have been drying out since he acquired them. Now, in spite of being deteriorated, they are rather fluffy. With sudden enlightenment, Vince says,
"Hey, bunny slippers! Egon, looks like you're wearing dirty bunny slippers. Don't they look like bunny slippers, Rupert?"
"Bunny slippers from hell," says Rupert.
Gottfried pulls his pistol, kills Vince with one round, and expends two on Rupert Baldwin, who was never a fast draw. He does not intuit any disapproval on the part of the unknown playwright. Violence is wanted. The script requires bloodshed. A more aggressive Egon Gottfried now comes on stage. "The bolo tie is stupid," he says to Rupert's corpse. After holstering his weapon, he wipes his shoes on the dead men's clothes as best he can. When he steps out of the barn, the lowering gray sky reminds him of the cerebral cortex of the human brain, fissured and softly folded. In the fissures, the clouds are blackening, as though the sky is the brain of the world and contemplating darker intentions. He follows the hardpan lane between the fields of weeds that have had significant influence on the changes in his character to the vehicles parked alongside the highway. From the customized Jeep Wrangler, he removes Rupert Baldwin's laptop and transfers it to the Rhino GX. As he is getting behind the wheel of his luxury SUV, the first thunder rolls through the clotted sky. Not a hard crash, but instead a soft, protracted rumble that isn't preceded by visible lightning. The storm hasn't yet begun, but it is imminent. Gottfried starts the engine. He hangs a U-turn and heads back toward distant Beaumont. There are still ways to find Jane Hawk's in-laws. After all, they are not ghosts, though he would like to make them so. A new understanding comes to him, a realization that he was never meant to plod through his scenes with an entourage consisting of the likes of Janice Dern and Chris Roberts and the Lobo brothers and Rupert Baldwin, and certainly not with a ludicrous specimen like Vince Penn. He is meant to be an iconic loner, which makes sense when he is the only real person in this story, and which therefore puts him at the center of it. He is expected to be a hero who stands tall and strong like Dirty Harry or Shane, a resolute champion of the revolution who takes no shit and no prisoners. For the first time in a while, he feels in sync with the author of the play. He suspects that in the frantic chase from Worstead to Beaumont and beyond, distracted more than assisted by his so-called team, he overlooked some clue. Now that he is a loner, he will be able to see events clearly, blow away the fog of war, so to speak, and convert Jane's arrogant in-laws into either adjusted people or dead people.
Chapter 13. Early Tuesday morning, Minette Butterworth, an English teacher, called her principal to say that she was taking a sick day and that her husband, Robert, who taught history, was also under the weather.
Neither Minette nor Bob had missed work due to illness in 6 years. Neither of them was in the habit of lying to their employer, either. Minette felt guilty about this deception, but Bob insisted it was for a good cause. They had been asked to assist in the search for the kidnapped boy, and the right thing to do was cooperate with the desperate authorities. As Bob reassured Minette, a still, small voice within her confirmed that this was the right thing to do. The deputies in the sheriff's department dared not go looking for the boy wearing their uniforms, in their police cars, because the kidnappers had said they would kill the poor child at the first sign of law enforcement closing in on them. Besides, there weren't enough deputies to do the job. They needed to deputize trustworthy locals and send them out into Borrego Valley to conduct the search without alarming the people who had snatched the precious child. The kidnappers were dangerous and surely armed. Minette was surprised that she didn't fear joining the hunt and was excited by the task ahead. The nice African-American, Deputy Kingman, had told her there was nothing to fear because she and Bob didn't have to confront the bad guys, only find them and then call in the deputies. She loved children. She'd not yet been able to have her own. A child being harmed, the thought sickened and outraged her. After a shower, when she stepped out of the stall and saw Bob naked and ready for his turn under the hot water, she was overcome by a sudden desire for him. Sex was best in the morning, before the day wore them down. She put her arms around him and kissed him. But then she realized how inappropriate it was to be making love when a 5-year-old child's life depended on them. She thought of herself as a flawed but basically good person, whose experience of tragedy had fine-tuned her conscience. Until this morning, however, her conscience hadn't actually spoken to her, as it did now, in a faint voice, to confirm Bob's insistence that participating in the search was the right thing. "You know what you need to do. Get on with what you need to do, and you will be useful and happy." As if Bob heard that same voice, he went to the shower without comment. Useful. At 18, Minette had been a frivolous girl, but she had become a serious adult almost overnight. For the past 15 years, her happiness had depended on doing penance in one way or another. She needed to be useful. She earned a living as a teacher, but spent nearly as much time in volunteer activities, counseling troubled children and working with organizations that served people with disabilities. Her freshman year in college, on her own for the first time, she had slipped the belaying lines of family. She dated a guy named Mace Mackey, who was in the first year of the master's program. Mace fancied himself bad to the bone, although in truth he possessed no moral substance, either bad or good, deeper than his skin. She found him so exciting that she didn't go home for the 3-month break before her sophomore year, but told her parents that she'd landed a good summer job with the university. There was no job. There was Mace, who came from a wealthy family and took care of Minette's finances, while she took care of his even more basic needs. Minette and her younger sister, Glynis, had always been close. Glynis missed Minette. 16 that summer, she wanted to come visit for a week. Minette, who thought of herself as sophisticated, looked forward to showing off her cute apartment and older boyfriend. The second night of the visit, the three were returning from a death metal concert, when unearned sophistication proved to have a high price. Behind the wheel of his Maserati, Mace was flying on some pills he'd been popping all day. Minette didn't insist on driving because that would annoy him. He was no fun when annoyed. Anyway, she had a bit of a buzz on herself from a joint and from sipping chocolate-flavored vodka. Mace totaled the Maserati. Fate proved to have a cruel sense of humor when he walked away without a scratch. Minette broke a finger, and Glynis, the only innocent among them, suffered a spinal injury that left her a paraplegic for life. Minette, who had felt enchained by her parents' old-fashioned middle-class ways, discovered that the chain of deserved guilt came with an immense anchor at the end, and couldn't be cast off as easily as bourgeois values. 15 years later, it still encumbered her. Useful. After the accident, she'd found happiness again only when she was useful, helping Glynnis and then others, always giving more than she received. Now, she could be useful by helping the authorities find the endangered boy. In the bedroom, after Minette pulled on a pair of panties, as she was shrugging into a bra, she saw the bruise in the crook of her right arm, the diameter of a bottle cap. Somewhat red, too, inflamed and swollen. When touched, the spot proved tender. She looked closer and saw a puncture centered in the discoloration directly over a vein, as if she'd had blood drawn, which she hadn't. Maybe a spider bite. A spider or some other insect. Nothing serious. Nothing to worry about. Nothing at all. Forget about it. After she dressed and went into the kitchen and fired up the coffee maker, while she waited for Bob, she walked down the hall to the guest room to make the bed. At the threshold, as she began to open the door, she realized no guest was in residence at the moment. Puzzled by her confusion, she pulled the door shut and turned away from it, and felt the terrible pull of that enduring anchor chain of guilt. Something was wrong. Something awful had happened. She must do the right thing. She must be useful. And somehow, being useful in this case required her to go into the guest room. She turned to the door, opened it. The room lay in darkness except for a few thin blades of light with which the sharp sun of the desert pierced the Venetian blinds. She stepped across the threshold and stood tense and blinkless in the gloom, listening. Then she flipped up the wall switch, and a nightstand lamp brightened the space. To her left, the bedclothes were in disarray. Someone had spent the night here after all. Perplexed, she took another step into the room, turned to her right, and saw a dead woman in a wheelchair. Oh, God! Her face. It was less a face than a wound. Ravaged flesh and shattered bone, her skull misshapen. But not just a woman. Not a stranger. Glynnis. Minette's heart. As Minette took a mug from a kitchen cabinet, her heart was suddenly thudding as if she had run a race. She put the mug on the counter, pressed a hand to her breast, and felt the systole of that vital pump. She detected no irregularity, only a healthy rhythm. Frowning, she raised her eyes from the mug to the cabinet door. She could not remember opening it. The kitchen was richly scented with the aroma of a fine Jamaica blend. Minette turned her attention to the burbling coffee maker. It was nearly finished brewing, having filled the Pyrex pot almost to the 8-cup line. Disquieted, but unsure why, she crossed the kitchen to the swinging door, which stood open. She went into the dining room, from there into the living room, and the house was less than entirely familiar to her, as though its angles and dimensions had subtly changed. On the brink of the hallway, she stared at the farther end. Her racing heart still could not find a calmer rhythm. As she moved along the hallway, she felt almost weightless, drawn inexorably toward the room at the end, which seemed to have the gravity of an entire planet contained within its walls. Halfway to the guest bedroom, Minette was halted by a vivid memory. The Maserati fishtailing at high speed, the back end jumping a curb, the car airborne, slamming into the oak, rebounding with the violence of the impact. Shaken, she tries the front passenger door, surprised to find it still works. She gets out, stumbles a few feet from the vehicle before regaining her balance, and turns. The rear passenger side door is crumpled like cardboard, jammed into the back seat, beyond the cocked and glassless window. Glynnis's face rises, moon white, and blood sprays on her breath when she screams. Minette stands trembling in the hallway, wondering why this horrendous memory should recur to her now in such graphic detail. Something was wrong with her. She wasn't herself, moving past perplexity toward a frightening bewilderment. She was also moving along the hall again. The guest room door. She opened it, stepped into the room. She flipped the light switch. The bedclothes were tangled and spilling off the mattress. Someone had slept here last night. Other signs of a visitor were to the right of the door, carpet stains and small pieces of debris. In the deep pile forest green carpet, the stains appeared black. Although the debris resisted identification, Minette became queasy at the sight of it, and she looked away. The door to the walk-in closet stood ajar. She stepped around the stains, crossed the room, opened the closet door, and discovered a wheelchair. The woman in the chair faced away from Minette, into the closet, her head tipped to the right. The back of the woman's head was broken open. A dangling chunk of skull bone was suspended by a flap of skin and strands of hair. Minette remembered this, remembered seeing the face now turned away from her. In fact, she herself had moved the wheelchair into the closet. Minette's heart. Sitting at the kitchen table, hands clasped around a mug of hot coffee, Minette Butterworth felt her heartbeat subside from a gallop to a more ordinary pace, and it no longer knocked against her breastbone. Paroxysmal supraventricular tachycardia, an acceleration of the heart when no cause was evident, had troubled her grandmother, and perhaps she had inherited a propensity for it. The condition wasn't life-threatening. Ventricular tachycardia, on the other hand, could lead to a sudden cessation of the heartbeat, and was far more serious than the supraventricular form, requiring a pacemaker. But her grandmother hadn't needed one, and neither would Minette. She didn't worry about the episode, because an inner voice said she had nothing to fear, nothing whatsoever, nothing, nothing. All would be well if she made herself useful. When Bob came into the kitchen, showered and shaved and dressed for the day, he drank his coffee while standing.
"We've got to get moving, men. We have our assignment. Places to look, people to see, a hell of a lot of them."
Getting up from the table, Minette said, "That poor little boy must be terrified. What kind of people kidnap a helpless child?"
"We have more damn crime in this country than the big shots in Washington will ever admit," Bob grumbled. "It's only going to get worse."
He drove their Toyota Tacoma pickup. She didn't need to give him directions. He'd memorized the assignment, which was unusual. Minette had a facility for memorization, especially when it came to poetry, but not her Bobby. He was an excellent teacher, but if she didn't give him a written list, if she just rattled off 5 items for him to pick up at the market, he would forget 1 or 2. Yet he remembered every detail of their complicated assignment, as if he were programmed. Happily, they didn't need to check on any of the folks in the other 3 residences on their little lane. Those people, too, had volunteered to assist in the search. They were darn good neighbors, and they were darn good people. Thinking about all of them wanting to help save that precious little boy, Minette was filled with a warm sense of community. She almost wanted to cry. Chapter 14. At 10:38, ahead of schedule, Enrique DeSoto's delivery man, Tio, arrived with the Tiffin Allegro motorhome